United States v. Webster.
Did you ever? Collins hates us.
Ms. Mulder.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kelly Mulder, and I represent Mr. Tommy Webster, the appellant. Mr. Webster's conviction should be vacated for three reasons. First, the evidence was insufficient to show that Mr. Webster constructively possessed the drugs and the guns found at the residence at 816 Almond Court. Second, the trial court admitted a recording obtained in violation of Mr. Webster's Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable search. The admission of this recording and the accompanying transcript was error and tainted the trial. And third, the trial court admitted testimonial lab reports via surrogate witnesses in violation of Mr. Webster's Sixth Amendment right to be confronted with the witnesses against him. These reports were admitted in error. There's no disagreement that it was error, and the error affected Mr. Webster's substantial rights. So first, the conviction should be reversed because the evidence was insufficient to support a constructive possession conviction. To show constructive possession of contraband found in a jointly occupied residence, as this one was, the government needs to do more than just connect the accused to the residence. The government has to connect the accused to the contraband itself.
But what evidence is there here of joint possession? I mean, although he could have sublet the residence, there's no evidence that he did so. He used that address on his license. He had mail, including water and utility bills, at the place. He was seen at the place by the neighbors. He referred to the residence in the tape as my house. In other words, what evidence is there that someone else resided at that house?
There's, I think, significant evidence other people resided at this house. There was mail in evidence.
One letter.
Written to other people. One of the letters was jointly addressed to Shea Culp and Tommy Webster. There were two other people in the home at the time. So Mr. Webster was outside of the home. There's no evidence that places him in the home that day. Two other people were inside the home that day with unfettered access to everything in the home. And so the constructive here, the link is between Mr. Webster and the residence. There might be that link. But there is no link between Mr. Webster and the drugs and the guns found in that residence. There's no witness testimony placing Mr. Webster with drugs or with guns.
Can I ask a clarifying question? About this linkage, are we talking about only the cocaine and the guns, or are you also including whether there was a link to show possession of the marijuana?
I don't think there's a link to show possession of any of the drugs or the guns. So marijuana, cocaine, or guns.
How big was the marijuana grow?
50 larger plants, 25 to 30 smaller plants in
Where
the basement of the home.
And you don't think it's reasonable to conclude he was in possession of those?
He was not in the home that day. He was outside of the home, and nobody placed him in the home. The only thing linking him to marijuana, arguably, you know, the government would argue, is that they smelled burning marijuana.
Or that anybody in the house would have been aware of the marijuana grow.
But he was not in the house. He was outside of the house.
That day.
Marijuana grow operations usually aren't moved in and out on a daily basis. But could you address the forfeiture issue on the sufficiency of the evidence? Aren't we subject to a plain error review here because there was no Rule 29 motion filed?
So, as the government pointed out, the attorney below did not make a motion for acquittal at the end of trial or at the close of evidence. So, yes, the burden of proof is very high. But I still think, given that, looking at the record, there are no witnesses. In all of these other cases where the government is making a constructive possession case, there is something more. There's witness testimony placing the defendant with drugs. There's a drug transaction that's occurring. The defendant is fleeing. There's something else going on. Here we have nothing like that. Nothing ever in the record of my client with drugs or with guns or even in the house that day.
This is a house that had three bedrooms?
The house had three bedrooms. Only one was maybe occupied. There was a bed in it.
So if anybody's an occupant, he's the best candidate, right?
I think if anybody's an occupant, it's probably the two people in the house that day. Mm-hmm. So both of those people, by the way, tried to flee the police. One of them, they both ran out the front door. One of them, Mr. Jones, the police apprehended. The other one ran back in the house and was so desperate to escape, he escaped out a second-story bathroom window, whereas my client didn't even try to run. Now, running, fleeing, as the Morris case shows, can be a plus factor, connecting defendants to contraband in these constructive possession cases. Now, as for the neighbor, Judge, you brought up neighbors testified that he lived there. Not exactly. Mr. Phillips, the neighbor, testified that he was the only person he'd known to have lived there, but he thought his kin was living there. Mr. Webster's kin was actually living at the house, and he'd only seen Mr. Webster once in all of March 2011, or those first 11 days. So that's the neighbor testimony. The landlord gave conflicting testimony. Mr. Reese is the homeowner, and at trial he testified on direct that Mr. Webster was living there. On cross, Mr. Reese admitted just the opposite, that he'd written a letter to his attorney, and in the letter he made the claim that Mr. Webster hadn't lived there at all at the end of 2010 and not at all in 2011. So it's unclear if there's any testimony that my client was living there, but that, even if he were, that's not enough. Something needs to connect him to these drugs or these guns, and nobody places him in the house that day. Nobody places him with drugs or with guns. No personal effects were found, no bracelets, no glasses, no wallets, nothing like that. Two other men were in the house that day and both tried to run away. The second reason his conviction should be vacated is because of this Fourth Amendment violation. So a recording was obtained in violation of Mr. Webster's Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable search. This occurred when the police put Mr. Webster and Mr. Jones in the back of a squad car, and they intentionally recorded this. The cop car recording was, or video was facing forward, so there's nothing, there's no image, there's just of these two people in the back seat, there's just the sound. So this is in violation of the Fourth Amendment because Katz tells us that warrantless searches are per se unreasonable. And Katz even contemplates this kind of contemporaneous electronic search and says even electronic surveillance substantially contemporaneous with an individual's arrest could hardly be deemed an incident of that arrest. So it doesn't fall under sort of that recognized exception. Given there's no law enforcement safety reasons for this kind of surveillance, the only possible reason to do it is to capture unwarned inculpatory statements.
Hasn't every circuit court that's addressed this issue found that there's no objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in the squad cars, given that there are visible recording devices? I mean, who common sense wise would think you had a objection that you had a right of privacy in a squad car?
I think there are two components: the subject component and the objective component. Subjectively, certainly, as I pointed out in the brief and the government's acknowledged, these two individuals stopped talking when the officer re-entered the car. Now, yes, other circuits have ruled on this in a rather perfunctory manner, but I think there's good argument for the reason that the only reason law enforcement would do this is to make an end run around these Fourth and Fifth Amendment protections. So you want to capture unwarranted inculpatory statements. Why else would you do it? And this led to the problems with the transcript introduced at trial, with nobody giving testimony as to whose voices were on the transcript, how they knew who was talking, that they could distinguish between Mr. Webster and Mr. Jones. And the tape's in the record. You can listen to it, and you have no idea who's talking. There's all sorts of conversations going on. So the fact that this became the center point of the trial becomes really problematic, and it tainted the whole thing. I need to reserve some time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mulder. Mr. Matuszak?
Thank you, Your Honor. You got my name correct.
Yeah. I remember it from the last time. I don't know if I got it right the first time, but...
No.
But my memory served me this time.
Thank you.
You hold a grudge.
Not with regard to that, Your Honor. Your Honor, my name is John Machasek, and I represent the government in this case. And I'd like to pick up with the question that Judge Rovner asked about what evidence was there of joint residence in this home. And there was some suggestion that other individuals had used the home. But there was really no evidence that there was joint residence. Now, my friend mentions that there was testimony by Mr. Phillips, who was the next door neighbor, and he said that the cousin, he thought maybe the cousin of the defendant, had been residing there for a short period of time. He didn't say that the defendant hadn't been residing there, but he said that he thought that there might have been a cousin that had been there as well. But that was not a very definitive statement to that effect. There was no other evidence at all that I can think of that placed anyone other than the defendant with regard to property interests in that home. He had a land contract with the home. He had made a payment on that land contract not long before the search in this case. I think there was a receipt from the land contract, from a land payment to the land contract holder's wife in the bedroom, the lone occupied bedroom on the second floor, that was only dated about a month and a half beforehand, which also directly contradicts the land contract holder's letter to his attorney that the defendant hadn't been residing there for a while. And the land contract holder also said that he did not receive the keys to the property back until 9 months after this search in December of 2011. As far as evidence of his substantial connection, assuming there was joint residency, there is sufficient evidence to show that there was a substantial connection between Mr. Webster, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, as we should in this circumstance, of his connection to the room on the second floor, which was the only room that appeared to be occupied, because there were two pieces of mail to him, a bank receipt that predated the, in his name, that predated the search by about 2 weeks, and then this land contract, or the payment for the land contract that was about a month and a half previous to that. There was also a coat in the closet in that room, and that was extra large and could have fit Mr. Webster I believe that was the testimony, but it was a large coat and he was a large guy. Now, as far as him not being in the house that day, I disagree with Ms. Mulder that there was no evidence that he was in the house that day. It's not necessary that he had been there, but the two officers went to the front door, one went to the back, and he heard the back door shut. He didn't have the back door in sight, but he heard the back door shut, and then right after that, he saw Mr. Webster leaving the property, headed to the east or headed away. He approached Mr. Webster, and he appeared to be surprised to see him. And then subsequently, on this tape that was played, or the excerpt that was played, he does say on that tape that I came out of the back, and as far as they know, I was just visiting, or I was just at the back door. So that implies that he puts himself inside the house himself, pursuant to that statement. Now, with regard to the right of privacy in a squad car, Judge Rovner is obviously correct that six circuits have ruled that there is no right of privacy in the back of a squad car. a couple of them, not all of them, as the appellant's brief says, have not provided an explanation. But several of those cases have. The 10th Circuit explained that a police car is an officer's office. I think that's in U.S. versus Clark, and that's 1993. It's a marked police car owned and operated by the state for ferreting out crime. It's also a trooper's office, a temporary jail. The public has no reason to expect that they may have privacy there. And there were similar reasons given by and Turner, 10th Circuit, regarding the interior of the car bristling with electronics. Now, the thing that I've wondered about in preparation for this argument is, can I think of a place where an individual would have less of an expectation of privacy than in the back of a police car? And I'm having a hard time figuring out where there might be a place that you wouldn't. But I might also mention something else that I didn't notice until preparing for this brief, for this argument, was that I'm not so sure that he didn't have a subjective expectation, that he didn't have privacy in the back of the car based on the transcript. Because he's asked during the conversation that he has in a car, a voice over the phone says, "What's in the house?" Mr. Webster says, "Nothing." Female says, "Not nothing?" He says, "Nothing." She says, "No guns, no dope like that?" And he says, "Why are we talking about that? What you do is you call down and find out what they say they found in the house. Don't ask me." So that implies to me that he at least had some idea that he shouldn't be talking about these things in the back of a police car, and that there might not be a subjective expectation. And oh, as far as the authentication of the transcript itself, there was testimony in the trial that Officer Hammer spent about 2 hours in the car with the defendant. And he did discuss with him real estate issues. That came out on cross-examination. And there was also testimony by Officer Kronwitter that he had had a conversation with Mr. Webster. And both those two officers were familiar with the defendant, would have been familiar with the defendant's voice as a result of that. Unfortunately, that didn't come out because there was no objection at the time. Now, finally, with regard to the plain error as far as the reports by Officer Sturgeon from the Indiana State Police, we did concede that there was error in admitting those reports, but the Supreme Court in Melendez-Diaz said three times that a defendant may choose for strategic purposes to waive the right to cross-examine an individual regarding reports, or to waive the right to object to the reports coming in. This court also said in U.S. versus Moon, it may be to the defendant's advantage to accept the hearsay version of evidence, which makes it problematic to entertain a Crawford claim via the plain error clause of Federal Rule Evidence 103. And in Maxwell, this court said the strategic decision to demand live testimony is the defendant's choice to make, and one that many defendants, in this case including Maxwell, may opt to forgo. And they were citing Melendez. And in this case, and I've laid it out in my brief, it's clear from looking at the defense attorney's questions, his opening statement, his closing arguments, and the questions of all of his witnesses, he agreed that there were drugs in the house. And that was part of his strategy. He said it in opening, he said it in closing. And I've run out of time, Your Honor, unless the court has any questions for me. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Mulder.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a few points in rebuttal. So first of all, there is not a lot of evidence in this case at all. Almost all of the mail found in the house was unopened. The lone occupied bedroom, there was really no personal effects there. There were three officers, two went to the front door, one walked around the side. He said he heard a door close. Didn't even say back door, could have been back door, but heard a door close, and Mr. Webster was walking toward, along the side of the house, toward this officer. So all of that, I mean, there's a lot of testimony on this. Nobody places him inside the house, and as for the tape and how much the government relies on that tape, even in this appeal, we don't know who's speaking on the tape. We don't know if it's Mr. Webster. We don't know if it's Mr. Jones.
No objection to that effect was raised at trial, was it?
I would like to address that point. So no objections were made at trial for the entire three-day trial. If you look at this trial transcript, a lot of problematic things happened at that trial. No objections were made. So it's frustrating to me to argue strategy, and that this attorney had some kind of robust strategy when he failed to make a motion for acquittal. And he didn't object to anything at all during the entire trial. And regarding the hearsay version being somehow less damaging, I can't see a strategy in allowing the government to put inadequate witnesses on the stand for these lab reports and then not doing any sort of robust cross-examination at all. I think if you had a strategy, you would have had a stipulation, and that's how it would have been put in the record. But this does not look, nothing about how that trial went looks strategic. Thank you.
All right, thanks to both counsel. Ms. Mulder, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Webster.
Thank you.